listening to the podcast version of Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Shapiro. Write the Book airs every Monday at 2 on The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, Burlington, Vermont. The show features all things book, especially interviews with authors, poets, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Julie Barton, author of the new memoir, Dog Medicine. Julie Barton is a writer, mother of two, and animal lover, who lives in Northern California. Her memoir, Dog Medicine, How My Dog Saved Me from Myself, was published in November 2015 by Think Peace Publishing. Julie Barton has a BA in English Literature from Kenyon College, an MFA in Writing from the Vermont College of Fine Arts, and an MA in Women's Studies from Southern Connecticut State University. Julie's writing has been published in Brainchild Magazine, The South Carolina Review, Louisiana Literature, Two Hawks Quarterly, Westview, The Huffington Post, and more. Mostly, she just tries to be kind to people and animals, according to her website. Avoid judgment, appreciate nature, and write every chance she gets. At 22, Julie Barton collapsed on her kitchen floor in Manhattan. She was 1 year out of college and severely depressed. She called her mom, who raced from Ohio to New York, picked Julie up, and took her home. Psychiatrists, therapists, and family tried to intervene, but nothing reached her until the day she decided to do one hopeful thing, adopt a golden retriever puppy she named Bunker. Dog Medicine captures in unforgettable language the anguish of depression, the slow path to recovery, and the astonishing way animals can help heal even the most broken hearts and minds. When I spoke to Julie Barton last week, I asked her to begin by reading the title piece from her memoir, Dog Medicine.
Dog Medicine, mid-July 1996. Bunker had been with me for 3 days, and we'd established a routine. Wake up, pee, poop, eat, walk, play, nap, and repeat. He was already mostly house-trained. He'd had only one accident on the carpet. I taught him to sit and make eye contact, and he did so eagerly, wanting to please, ready for the next command. Waking up in the morning was getting easier, but something dark still lingered. And on this particular day, for no discernible reason, the darkness reared its ugly head, unannounced, worse than ever, like a thread-thin worm that had covertly dug itself back into my body from underneath the fingernail. It said, "Oh, no, you don't. I see you, trying to pretend you're happy, trying to fool people that you're not a lazy, ugly idiot." I felt punished, as if my captor had caught me trying to escape. Perhaps those awful thoughts had never left, but just lay dormant for a while. I wanted to fight. I tried hard to push the negativity away, but it persisted. "Just getting a dog can't cure me," I thought. I was the problem. I wasn't strong enough. I was a failure, a crazy person. I was truly unlikable. I believed this, like I believed that the earth was round, something I couldn't see, but understood to be true because I had been told it was so. I walked to the maroon living room couch and sat down, feeling both afraid and comforted by the reappearing blackness. Comforted because I knew depression so well. Depression was my companion. The seductive descent into the awful depths marked the return of an old, dark friend that I genuinely, honestly missed. I had my face in my hands, my body sat small and inert. Breathing became tight, uneven. My parents' great efforts to help me had failed. I had failed. I was so broken. I would never leave home, never keep a job, never be happy. There was no stopping the cascade of terrible, dark, frightening thoughts. Such is the nature of depression. Even the most Herculean effort to find light and positivity will be extinguished. There seems to be no such thing as solace. My face was still in my hands when I felt warmth on my toes. Bunker had walked over to me and sat down on my feet. I pulled my hands away from my face and saw him sitting, looking up at me, his butt squarely on my toes, his back leaning into my shins. His face held curiosity, this fevered puppy energy completely contained. He glanced away for a few moments and then turned back as if to ask, "Better?" "Really?" I thought. "Really? Could this dog somehow sense when I was sad and comfort me?" I had heard of seeing eye dogs. I'd heard of dogs who could sniff out drugs in suitcases. But a dog who could detect sadness? A dog who could sense a downtick in mood? I wondered if these new psychiatric drugs were causing me to overly anthropomorphize my dog. But I needed so desperately to be comforted. I needed a companion who had no judgment, with whom I had no history, who would make it known that I was loved, who would never, ever hurt me. So I decided in that moment to trust what I was feeling. Then I remembered the approach that my therapist suggested I try the next time I felt down. She told me not to fight the sorrow. "It's okay to be sad sometimes," she said. "Everyone is sad sometimes. Let the sad feelings in. Be with them. Then see what happens. It's not so bad, right? Ask those dark thoughts, are you true? Are you real?" So I decided to be as sad with Bunker as I needed to be, because he didn't care. He accepted me. He didn't need me to be happy. He had witnessed my change in mood, and that alone improved it. He didn't judge me. He simply saw me. So I told myself, Bunker understands. But it was a whole new kind of understanding. It was wordless, and it let me be sad until an amazing thing happened. The sadness began to dissolve. I was safe with this dog, and the near instant effect was that the desperation and darkness disappeared, burst in the air like soap bubbles. So I let more sadness in. I felt it. I really felt it. Then I petted Bunker, and the sorrows didn't seem nearly as big or awful. They even felt untrue, like, "Oh, you're not really stupid and ugly and lazy. Of course. You're not really hopeless, are you?" "No, you are not." I don't know why it worked. All I can ponder is that this kind of healing required the safety of a true companion and no resistance. This kind of healing did not want me to fight my sadness. It wanted me to accept it, welcome it even, so that the depression could be on its merry way. And Bunker wanted no wrangling of labels to explain my emotional state, my bottomless malaise. He brought only judgment-free listening and wordless faith. When it came to Bunker, I was overflowing with faith. There was something sacred in this dog, connected to the wisdom of nature but living inside my home. As a child, I'd accessed that wordless, wise place so many times during my treks through the woods and with my beloved dogs, Midnight, Blarney, and Cinder. Those places, those dogs had no opinion about themselves or me, aside from acceptance. Bunker was still sitting on my feet, still looking at me. His feather soft fur tickled my legs, and I picked him up, his puppy legs dangling. I cradled his body. He let his tongue drop out the side of his open mouth. That sight alone made me smile. I leaned back into the couch and held him to my chest. He curled into me as if he felt as protected as I did. I took a deep breath and felt the blackness loosen its grip. Dog medicine. I found it, and I swallowed it whole.
Thank you very much for reading that. That's wonderful. Your book made me cry, I have to say. I loved your book, and at the end, I was, like, weeping. My husband's like, "What's wrong?"
I hear that a lot.
I bet. So I'm going to actually jump to the beginning of the book. The first sentence of the book is, "The walk to my apartment was 6 blocks, but I wasn't sure I would make it." And we soon learn that you were depressed living in New York, and that one of the ways in which this manifested was an inability to function and a deep, inescapable need to sleep. I thought this was such an excellent opening to your story, because of your story, but also just to the concept of what depression can do to a person, for anyone who doesn't know. So I thought maybe we could have a little discussion at the beginning here about depression and the ways that it can affect people.
Well, depression is wily. It's a beast, and I think it affects different people differently. But the way that it manifested itself for me was I just wanted to sleep, and it wasn't as if I just thought, well, I'm going to sleep because I'm sad. It was fatigue that was physical, pulling me out of consciousness. I just had to sleep.
Yeah.
And it was a relief to be asleep. Waking up was very difficult. But that was how it manifested itself for me. But you can't sleep all the time, right?
Right.
Your body's going to... But I did. I slept 20 hours a day at times. And some of it was exhaustion. Some of it was my brain. And I've talked to people who have had the opposite, where they're depressed and anxious, and they don't sleep for weeks.
Mm.
And that can bring on a whole other kind of problem.
Sure.
But for me, sleep was a relief, but it also became a bit too much after a while, and mm-hmm. I slept for days.
Yeah. You write in the book about your family life as a child. You had very loving parents, mm-hmm. and a brother who had a lot of rage inside of him, and he used to react to his own feelings of, I came to realize he was an insecure person in his own kind of pain, and he lashed out at you. He was very unkind and abusive, both emotionally and physically. He once broke down your bedroom door in a rage. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how this affected you and also talk about your parents' reactions to this.
Mm-hmm. Well, for years, I didn't think it affected me at all. For years, I thought, you know, brothers and sisters fight, and my brother and I fought, and mm-hmm. it wasn't until I got into pretty serious therapy after this breakdown in New York that I realized that it had a profound effect on me and the way I thought about myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very reluctant to come to terms with that fact. I had a friend in college who, we'd had an argument, and she wrote me a letter saying, "I think the way your brother treated you has really affected you." And I was so outraged that I didn't speak to her for the rest of college.
Wow.
Which tells you that there was some real truth that I was scared to face in that letter. She
yeah.
was wise. She was a wise, wise friend, and I'm very sorry for how I treated her. But that's what happens in a depressed mind. You know, the fear and the rage is inward, and then it comes outward, and then it's inward. And my brother... yeah, he was having a really hard time, and I didn't know this. And one of the things that I have learned in my many years of thinking and writing about this scenario is that the way he treated me had nothing to do with me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was my mistake to believe that it did. And it became my job to forgive myself for believing him, for believing the insults and the things he said to me and the way he treated me. And my parents... they're very loving, and they're very kind, and they made some mistakes, as all parents do.
Mm-hmm.
They missed how serious this was for me. I was a very sensitive kid to begin with. It was, I always call it the perfect storm, because I was super sensitive. My brother was unhappy and taking it out on me, and my parents were trying to keep food on the table and do their jobs and keep the house in order. And my mom didn't have brothers. She had sisters. And my dad was an only child. And their reference point was not really one. And
yeah.
so they thought this is what siblings do. And they did try to do their best, but they just didn't know.
Yeah.
And I didn't articulate it as a kid because I didn't know either. I didn't know that it wasn't normal. And it took a long time and many therapists telling me it wasn't normal and many hours of me going, God, those therapists are so whiny. They're so whiny, and they just want to say how bad it was and how awful it was and how you don't know how bad you had it. And finally, after, you know, years of that, I said, okay, maybe they're right. Maybe they're onto something. But it doesn't mean that, you know, I say, well, dear brother, my depression is all your fault. I don't believe that.
Right.
A different person would have come to that scenario in a different way. They would have fought back. They would have said, you're out of your mind. You know, I just happened to be very absorption oriented. Yeah. I took it all in. Yeah. I took it all in and I believed what he said. And that was my job to forgive myself for that as I grew older.
Yeah. And I think too, like reading your book, it struck me that, you know, we're used to in this day and age, we know what abuse looks like, you know, and this would have been, I think I would have also talked myself out of seeing this as abuse. You know, it's like it's sibling rivalry. You know, he's acting out and I'm being oversensitive, but it was over the top.
It was. And I didn't really know that. And I didn't see it that way at all for a long, long time. And it was pretty difficult to come to that conclusion. It was difficult for my whole family that I said that, because I'm not the kind of person who can come to a conclusion and realize, okay, that happened, and then keep it to myself.
Yeah.
Sadly, us writers, us memoirists have to talk about it. And so, you know, I did. Before I wrote the book and while I was writing the book, I talked to my family and I said, this is what it was like for me. And they were so sad.
Yeah.
They were so sad for me and so sad that they didn't know, you know, how to help, and that they didn't do what I needed, but I didn't know I needed it and neither did they.
So. Now, in your interactions with your own family, you have children. Do you feel like your experience of sibling rivalry has helped or hindered your ability to deal with it in your own family, or is that too personal?
You know, it's fine. I think it's helped because I fostered a friendship in my daughters. I have two girls, which might make it a little easier.
Mm-hmm.
But I really worked on fostering a friendship between them when they were little. They're 11 and 8 now.
Mm-hmm.
And as much as they might be annoyed with each other at times, you know, over the weekend they went to the park by themselves for about 4 hours and built a fort and had a picnic in it. And they like each other.
Mm-hmm.
And they have had moments, because they are children and children do this, where they've hit each other. And I know I've overreacted.
Mm-hmm.
And I say to them, this is not something we do. When you're frustrated, we use our words. We don't use our bodies. You know, that can really cause harm. And it's a little bit easier probably with girls. I don't know. I don't have boys. But maybe they'll grow up and say, wow, Mom, you never let us fight, and now we have all this anger. I don't know. I don't know.
My therapist says you should have let me fight more.
I mean, we all make mistakes as parents. We really do. And that's one of the beauties of becoming a parent yourself, when you have, you know, a story about your own childhood, is you realize, okay, my parents are really doing their very best, and they came at it with such love. And, yeah, they had some blind spots, but I'm sure I have my own too.
Yeah.
And so all you can do is be as loving as you can and show up, which my parents always did. They always showed up.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to ask you a craft question as far as the actual writing of the memoir. Early chapters in this book always, or almost always, not always, but often end with a little paragraph about what might have been going on in your puppy Bunker's life before you adopted him, while these other things were going on for you. So you'll have a chapter about, you know, your experience in New York and how you were feeling, and your mother came to help you. But then there's a little paragraph at the end about, you know, the second day of Bunker's life, and there was a partial solar eclipse. And anyway, I just wondered how you came to that, to include his full life story in writing yours.
That's a great question. I didn't at first, and I sent the book out to some agents, and one agent asked to see the whole manuscript and said, it's lovely writing, but I thought it was going to be more about the dog.
Mm.
And I went, of course. The first, you know, 75 pages, there was no dog, and that's asking a lot of the reader to hang in with you for 75 pages before they get to see a glimpse of the dog. So, and this is one of the magical parts of writing memoir, is so I thought, okay, well, how could I do this? And I went back and I looked at my journals and I looked at calendars and I looked at the timing, and I realized then that he was born right around the day that I collapsed.
Hmm.
And it was just this, like, magical moment that kept happening, because so then, you know, one of the big metaphors in the book is the moon.
Yeah.
So I looked at the moon on the day he was born, and the day after he was born, which was my second day lying on the floor in complete despair in Manhattan, there was a partial solar eclipse. And so there was complete darkness for a moment. And it was like, oh my gosh, he can't see. His eyes aren't open yet. He's still just searching and fumbling for nourishment from his mother. And here I am searching and fumbling in the dark as well, because I'm asleep most of the time and I'm in such darkness, mm-hmm. fumbling for my mother as well. And it was this beautiful synergy, this moment where I could say, you know, I write, maybe I'm breaking rules, but I write my idea of what the scene was like when he was born. And my idea of what he was going through on his second day. And I did research about, you know, the lives of puppies and the risks that they run into. And I've seen enough of, you know, litters in my life to know what he was going through. And the parallels were incredible. Mm-hmm. And I found that throughout the whole writing process. You know, when you really pause and pay attention and take in ideas from all around, you find these incredible parallels that are so powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to ask you another craft question. I noticed occasionally in the book you mention things that have larger implications to the whole story to kind of help the reader follow along, even if these moments won't be followed up in scene or great detail. So, for example, you write, "I had spent so many nights in this room dreading the next day. It was in this room that I had sought refuge. It was in that closet that as a teenager I had flown into an uncontrollable rage and broken everything in sight, pulling the rod and shelves out of the wall, my mom too scared to enter the room until the noise stopped." And it goes on from there, and obviously you're in your childhood home at this point. So I wonder if you can talk about this kind of summation of events that give an overall impression but don't necessarily require a detailed scene.
That is a great question. I love it. So all of those at once were standalone scenes.
Oh, they were?
There's a scene like that, and then there's another scene where I mentioned trying to jump out of my dad's car as he's driving down the freeway.
Yes, yes.
And I mention it in a similar kind of very passing way, and that used to be its own standalone scene.
Okay.
And I decided in the many revisions to put those in as mentions to show the immensity of what I was feeling.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't feel at that point that I needed to go into the details of that moment, for various reasons, because it would have either been, I already did, and people are getting the idea, and this is just a little, another boost of this same idea. And also, I think that you don't necessarily need to go into scene for a moment to have impact in memoir.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes giving it in a more brief summary can be just as impactful, because the reader will be, you know, reading a full scene and say, okay, they want me to get this. And then just like where you noticed as you were reading, wow, okay, she busted up her whole bedroom and pulled the rod out of the closet. Like, and they just mentioned that. Imagine what else was going on, or, you know, that's a, and so it's like by making it a little bit less of a focal point, it stands out.
Yes.
And it just, and also I think you have to be really measured in how much you say things were hard.
Yes.
Oh, it can get really tiresome for a reader to read scene after scene of your hardship.
Yeah.
Nobody really wants to go there for that long, which is why, you know, if you know as you're writing that, you know, things that are hopeful are going to happen, it'll help the reader hang on to something, because
right.
we love hope and we love love and we love joy, but we also really love understanding how we get through it when it's not there or when it's not available to us.
Yeah.
And so that's partly why in the beginning, that beginning chapter is a rough scene. You know, I'm collapsing on the floor in this confused, you know, psychological, you know, falling out. And then we see the birth of a puppy.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll keep us going to the next chapter, because otherwise it's just like, oh, gosh, this is a really hard read. And it is a hard read.
Yeah.
But You know, it might keep you going to know that there's a puppy in your future. Literally and metaphorically. Yeah.
So I'm just going to rephrase something you just said that I never really thought about before, but I think this is a really good point for writers, and that is, you know, walking into the bedroom and describing the bedroom, you know, I'm making this up, I don't know what your room looked like, but blue shag carpet and white curtains and da-da-da. But in fact, the most intense, vibrant detail in that whole description is that sentence about the closet, I think. Mm-hmm. And in a way, mm-hmm. that becomes its own, like, moment in another scene instead of needing a full scene of its own.
Mm-hmm.
So is absolutely. That sort of what you're saying? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can pop in some details here and there for sure, just to sort of set the reader in the place. But if you want to give a setting emotional resonance, you can do that really quickly mm-hmm. with a small detail of an event.
Yeah.
But, you know, I do think it's at some point, maybe not in that particular passage, but at some point you do need to sort of describe the space a little bit. So that, you know, you can see like the track trophies and the, like you're saying, the carpet and the curtains. But in another scene, you can give that room a tone by one line about something that happened or two lines. And it changes the tone of the room from innocent childhood bedroom with, you know, a wall of books and stuffed animals to, wow, there was something going on here.
An event. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I just would love to read another sentence to you. This is from a scene in New York. After you adopt an animal that you call the wrong dog, okay, earlier in the narrative and earlier in your story, you adopted a dog and it was the wrong dog for you. And this is a line from the book, or a couple lines. The sadness swallowed me as I walked back into my apartment and went to bed alone. I lay there promising myself that I would never, ever tell a soul what I had just done. That jumped out at me because, of course, you're telling everybody what you had just done. And I wondered how you felt writing that. Did it feel very freeing to be able to write about it after once feeling that you could never talk about it? And I guess I mean about a lot of the details in this book that are part of your life that were hard for you.
I wrote that scene and took it out and wrote it and took it out and wrote it and took it out.
Interesting.
And it was a really hard one for me to put in. Because I felt so terrible for what I'd done to that dog. And when I look back on it, I think he probably thought he was just going for a walk.
Right.
And then I think it was a girl, and then she went back to the shelter for the afternoon. What an interesting walk. I got to go into an apartment. But, you know, for me, I felt it was a scary moment for me because all my life, dogs had been such a place of peace and solace. And I brought this dog into my house, and it was chaos and fear and no connection.
Uh-huh.
And it was more of what I didn't need, and so I took it back. And there's a lot of shame in the dog community around taking a dog back to a shelter. Hmm. And it's different, I think, if you take them back after a day. But I felt so much shame about that, that I'd done something bad to the species that had saved me so many times, and that perhaps that magic that I always felt with animals and with nature as a child was gone, which was terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
But I can tell you, I took that scene out more times because I was ashamed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, a key probably that you need to include it when you go, I can't say this.
Right.
And some things, you know, when it has to do with other people, that it might hurt them, you really do need to take it out.
Right.
But this one was a dog that, you know, I never really had a life with, and it was really more about me and my searching.
Mm-hmm.
And writing memoir is very tricky territory. You have mm-hmm. to be careful about what you say, and you have to give everybody that you write about a copy of the book before it comes out and say, are you okay with this? And Pam Houston calls it a compassion read. Before mm-hmm. you publish it, you have to do one of your final edits needs to be a compassion read. Are you compassionate to everybody in the story? And I love that because memoir cannot ever be revenge, you know, literature ever.
Right.
It just can't. It has to be the truth. of what you know and what you remember. And so that particular scene was hard for me because that was difficult, and I felt bad for what I'd done.
Well, I'm glad you left it in, actually, because I think it's a good message to have in the book. I mean, people are going to read this book for lots of different reasons, I think, some just to learn your story and some because they perhaps can relate to your depression. But I think it's an important step that, or an important part of the story, that this isn't just magic, and it's not necessarily any dog will fix any situation, you know?
Absolutely.
So I felt that was really good. I'm glad you kept it in.
Yeah, well, and, you know, I've been saying as I've been on tour that not every dog is a medicine dog in the way that Bunker was. Mm. I think that, you know, I wrote something once about how dogs come to us for reasons, and somebody who has, like, you know, a 90% clogged artery gets a very active dog who wants to go outside all the time. And somebody who needs to learn responsibility has a dog who's very hard to train, and maybe that's true, but the dog I have now is not a medicine dog, much to my dismay. I thought all dogs were, and then I adopted my current dog, who's awesome and lovely and sweet, but we're his fourth home, and he brings more issues than he heals. But he's also medicine in a way, because, you know, they're all different. They're different. He's a little nuts, but he's not a Bunker, but he's good. Nobody can ever fill poor Bunker's shoes. I mean, they're just doomed.
Yeah. So I'm about to break one of my own rules, which is I don't tend to talk about myself in these interviews, but I have to tell you, when I was reading this, I'm from Newark, Ohio.
Oh.
And I went to Columbus School for Girls.
You did not.
I did too. Did you go to Columbus School for Girls? You don't name the school.
I did go to Columbus School for Girls.
Yes, I totally knew it. I was like, oh my God, she went to Columbus School for Girls.
Wild.
Isn't that funny?
Oh my, that's wild.
Yeah. So I had to say that. Also, like Raccoon Creek and Pataskala and Alexandria. Like, I'm reading this book, I'm like, oh my God, oh my God.
You know those places.
So funny, yeah.
You are
10 years younger than I am, so I doubt that we would probably ever have crossed paths at Columbus School for Girls. But
love it.
Yes. Anyway, so that was so funny for me. Okay. So as I was reading about Bunker, it occurred to me that wanting a puppy, even maybe before that scene where you adopted the wrong dog, it felt like wanting a puppy was maybe the first step toward your healing. Do you feel that way?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It was the first hopeful thing I'd said since I got home. It was the first thing I thought, this might help me.
Mm.
I had been monosyllabic and I had been horizontal for weeks. And, you know, my dad coming home and picking me up and making me go for a walk and going to therapists, and, you know, that had started to get me, but I had never said, maybe this would help. And so when I said to my mom, I think I want to get a puppy, she said, okay, great. Which, you know, that's not a small thing to invite a peeing, pooping, chewing, crazy animal into your house.
Right.
And she had no hesitation whatsoever and knew that that was something that would help me and help me get it done.
Yeah, yeah. After you have adopted Bunker, you write, "It occurred to me as I gently stroked his side that this was the first time in recent memory that I was reassuring another living thing. And miraculously, I knew in that moment that I was more than capable of caring for him." So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the joy and even maybe the healing power of being needed and being able to care for some other person or creature.
Yes, it's huge. When you're a depressed person, people start to treat you like you're not very capable, not only of caring for anything, but for caring for yourself. And so they ask very little of you, which in a way is a gift, but in a way it backfires because you start to believe you're not capable of anything and of taking care of anything, you know, yourself first and foremost. And having this dog gave me a reason to live, really, truly. I had to get up. I had to take him outside which in itself was healing. Going outside was really wonderful for me, just to stand and, you know, he had to pee in the middle of the night when he was a puppy, and I'd go out and I'd stand and look at the stars and the moon, and that's healing right there.
Yeah.
There was never a question that I could give this dog the best possible life, and if only because that moment on the couch that I read from, where he came and he saw me, that was the lock that locked our lives together, because I know, you know, it wasn't a coincidence. I know he sensed it because he did it his whole life.
Mm-hmm.
He would come from across the house if I was having a bad moment. In fact, I have some video of it. I was doing like a video journal,
mm-hmm.
and I was started to cry, and then you see his little head pop out from behind the, I'm sitting on the floor next to the bed, and you see his head pop out, and he's just sort of looking, panting, kind of turns towards me, and I don't even see him, but he knew. And so, you know, it was in my very best interest to take good care of him, but also I was so grateful that this soul had been blessed to me,
yeah.
that I knew I could take care of him. And, you know, as you know in the book, when he suffers a devastating diagnosis, I didn't lie on the couch and cry and think, I'm never going to, you know, he's going to die and I'm going to die and we're all, I did everything I could to save him,
mm-hmm.
which was really empowering for me, because I didn't care about much. I really
yeah.
didn't. But I cared about this dog more than I cared about myself for a long time.
Yeah.
And that was okay, because he was my constant companion. And he also taught me, because how devoted he was to me, that maybe I'm worth something. Maybe mm-hmm. I'm okay, because he loves me and he's smart.
Absolutely. Dogs are very empathic. They kind of know.
They do.
They know who's who. Now, we already talked a tiny bit about this, but I just want to kind of glance off of it again, and that is, when you're doing readings, when you're touring with this book, I'm sure you meet other people who suffer from depression. Do you have advice for them about whether or not to look into getting a pet? You know, I mean, it takes a certain energy level and level of responsibility to care for another creature. So what would you recommend?
Yes, it's a tricky question, because I would never say to somebody, oh, you're depressed, go get a dog.
Mm.
I was in a very privileged and rare position in my life to be 22, living at home. I had no financial needs. My parents were taking care of me, and I had all the time in the world. I had a summer to be with this dog and to train him and to bond with him, and
mm-hmm.
that set the foundation for our lives together, and that's a very unusual position to be in.
Mm-hmm.
I have told people who have come up to me at readings and said, you know, I think I want a dog, which actually is, it's less often than people come up and say, yes, I have a dog who has saved me, which has happened so many times. It's been just
mm.
wonderful.
Yeah.
But to somebody who says, I'm depressed, I think I'm going to get a dog, I would be careful. I wouldn't do that right away. I
mm-hmm.
would take a very careful stock of your life, how much time you have. If you work full time, I wouldn't recommend it at this mm-hmm. point, unless you have a summer off and you can really dedicate time, or, you know, a month or two off, because the dogs are needy. They really
yeah.
are. And they're a lot of work, and it's a gift to have them, but it's also, you have to have time. Though I've also talked to families, you know, there are people in my community who, they're in the midst of a divorce and the kids are suffering, and mom decides to get a dog, and the whole family is brought together because of this little ball of energy in their house. And so, you know, you might look at that situation and think, God, mom of, you know, two or three kids, and she's single now and solo, and why would she get a dog? And it's been the best medicine for their whole family.
Mm-hmm.
So I think every situation is different.
Yeah.
And so I wouldn't say, like, you know, go get a dog is like taking a vitamin at all. It's really a case-by-case situation. And I met a woman in Portland who was just lovely, and she was a single mom, and she said, you know, I don't have a dog, but my roommate has a dog, and this dog is my medicine. And I said, that's perfect, because
yeah.
it's her roommate's dog, and so she gets the benefits, but doesn't have, she's, you know, is a single mom with lots of kids, and she doesn't have the time and the you know, the bandwidth left to take care of a dog full time, but she gets the benefit of having this beautiful animal in her life. So, you know, I've said to people, ask your friend who has a dog who's easy on the leash and a good, you know, hiking buddy to go for a walk with you. And I have a friend recently who's been going through a tough time, and she's called about 4 or 5 times and said, can I come and take Jackson, who's my current dog, on a hike? And I was like, absolutely, go for it. And she'd go and walk for a couple hours and come back, and they were both happy when they got back. So there's many ways to go about it. So I'm not at all advocating, oh, if you're depressed, go get a dog.
No, yeah.
And there's more than one kind of animal medicine. There's cat medicine. There's there's ride a horse medicine. I'm not going to write those books. Somebody else can do those. But
gerbil medicine.
You never know. Help the animal kingdom.
Right. You had a therapist. One of the chapters in the book talks about your relationship with one of the therapists who you saw who was helpful to you, and she had an expression: automatic negative thoughts. I wondered if we could just talk about that a little bit. I think I found that to be a helpful idea and probably somewhat universal, even for people who don't actually have clinical depression. But, you know, we all get down on ourselves. And I really liked the idea of that, automatic negative thoughts.
Yeah. Yeah. And an automatic negative thought is when you don't even notice. It's just sort it flies past the radar.
Yeah.
And the job of a getting undepressed is getting mindful of them. And it's the basic theory behind cognitive behavioral therapy, which is where I was working with that woman, with that wonderful young therapist that I saw right after I got home. Mm-hmm. And it's essentially just start to notice your thoughts. Just start. You don't have to change them. You don't have to judge them. Just notice them. And that can be such an incredible experience if you've not done that in your life, if you've not practiced that. If you spend 5 minutes of your day noticing what's happening inside your brain, in your thoughts, you know, they talk about, and I don't know if this is true scientifically, but they talk about, you know, thought grooves and grooves in your brain that are established when you're young, that, you know, mine were, you're worthless, nobody likes you, you're ugly, everybody hates you, and everything you do is wrong. And, you know, that was the constant chant in my mind. And yet I never noticed that. I never knew that. And so surviving that was really difficult, and I barely made it through. That breakdown was the culmination of years and years of that kind of thinking and me not really noticing, me just trying to get along. And when you think that way and you're full of that much self-loathing and you start to become not a fun person, not a nice person, you're not nice to others and yourself because you're really struggling and hurting. Mm-hmm. And the cognitive behavioral therapy just gets you to start to notice what conclusions did you draw based on this event. You know, you accidentally rear-end somebody because they stopped fast. What conclusions do you draw? Do you draw that you're a bad driver, you're not paying attention, you're being careless in your life, or do you draw the conclusion that they stopped very quickly, you did everything you could, but you hit them and everything is going to be okay, it's just a car? Mm-hmm. You know, there's from every scenario in your life, there are conclusions that we draw, and we don't notice often what they are until, for depressed people in particular, until we're depressed, mm-hmm. until we're so far down that we start to lose function and suffer. So the noticing the thoughts is the first key, and now they call it mindfulness. Call it whatever you want. Call mm-hmm. it CBT, call it mindfulness. It's paying attention, and it's noticing, and noticing is the first step towards enlightenment.
Yeah. Great. Julie, what are you writing these days?
I'm writing a lot of interviews, a lot of I'm writing a piece now about the magic I discovered while I was writing this book, And by magic, I mean the connections that I made, which mm-hmm. I call magic because they feel so magical, like the one I was talking about with the moon and the one I was talking about with discovering that the time Bunker was born was the time I collapsed. Mm-hmm. And so I'm writing a piece about that. And then after that, I think I've got another memoir in me.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. And I also just, I write for the joy of it, not for the next book kind
right.
of thing.
Yeah.
Okay. I've been writing for years and years, and it's a source of happiness for me. It's not my vocation.
Yeah.
Although it kind of feels like it right now, which is great, but I but I write for the joy of it, not for anything else. And also to save myself,
yeah.
you know, and to keep beautiful things alive like Bunker.
Yeah.
And to make sense of my life and to find that beautiful connection that makes me gasp.
Yeah.
So I will always be writing, and I'm sure I'll be publishing a few things. I don't know what, but I'm sure something's out there.
Yeah. And then I also wanted to ask what you have read lately that you might recommend to people who love to read.
Oh, goodness gracious. So I love that. So there's, gosh, I have a stack. I read about 5 books at once, which I know is a bad idea, but I can't help myself. I'm like, oh, that looks so good. And then I start, and oh, that looks so good. So, of course, there's Mary Carr's New, The Art of Memoir, which I really enjoyed. And I met her. I didn't meet her, but I know I went and fawned over her at a reading. She was just so so brilliant and crazy and funny and, you know, wisecracking. I loved her. I'm reading The Hunger Makes Me a Modern Girl, Carrie Brownstein's. I just started
okay.
that. And then this one book called My Old Dog, which is a collection. It's by a woman named Laura Coffey. And it's a collection of stories about dogs that are adopted as seniors.
Uh-huh.
And it's beautiful because the senior dogs really do bring medicine.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think my next dog is going to be a senior dog. I think my kids are old enough that I can say, you know, he's old, so let's be gentle and let's give him the best of his last years.
Yeah.
Do you want more?
No, that's great. That's great.
Okay.
Those all sound really good.
Yeah.
So I have one last question for you, and we actually touched on this a tiny bit, but I think it's worth talking some more about, because people who write memoir, I think this is always, always an issue, and that is advice for writing about family or friends or other communities that might react or judge or perhaps be hurt by what we write. What advice do you have for undertaking that kind of project?
Yeah, it's an important question, absolutely. And so for the people who are going to judge, I don't care, and you shouldn't care either.
Mm-hmm.
The people who are going to be hurt, and the people in your family, and the people that are your close friends, you have to be careful, and you have to say, this is what I'm thinking about. You have to give them the pages before you publish it and say, are you okay with this? And if they say, I don't want to read it, then you have to say, well, okay, well, then do I have your blessing to do this, and or give them, you know, an email with the short scene so they can read it in a nutshell. Or,
mm-hmm.
But it's important that they read it and that they're okay with it. I gave my book to my parents and my brother, and they were all extraordinary, very gracious and humble. You know, they said this is our truth and this is our family, and we all did our very best. And my brother in particular, honestly, after seeing his reaction to this story and that him saying that was really hard for me to see how harsh I was, but he said, you wrote a really good book and I'm really, really proud of you and I would never stand in your way. Having
That's
those conversations, yeah, I mean,
yeah.
talk about healing.
Yeah.
And realizing he's not the child that he was. He's a beautiful human being. He's grown into a wonderful man. And we probably would never have gotten there and had those really difficult conversations if I hadn't been a writer, if I hadn't written this book. And so, you know, tread carefully, tread with the deepest compassion you possibly can, and write with the deepest compassion and empathy that you possibly can, and then share it and have those difficult conversations.
Yeah.
That would be my advice. And keep going, even if you're scared and even if you think this is never going to go well. Just keep going, and you never know.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's great advice. The book is Dog Medicine, How My Dog Saved Me From Myself, written by Julie Barton and published by Think Peace. Thank you so much for being on Write the Book today.
Thank you so much. That was wonderful.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Julie Barton. You can learn more about her work at her website, byjuliebarton.com. That's by, B-Y as in a byline, byjuliebarton.com. Julie tweets at juliebarton1111. This week's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Julie Barton, and is based on wild writing work she has done with San Francisco writing coach Lori Wagner, who leads online workshops as well as Bay Area classes. Julie says that wild writing is a phenomenal writing practice. Here's the basic assignment. Write by hand. Read the poems that I'm going to put on the Write the Book website, and then write for 15 minutes. Write as fast as possible, and even as poorly as possible, without thinking. By letting your subconscious lead the way, you'll be more likely to access work you might otherwise never get to. I'm not going to read the poems on the air as I don't have permission for that, but here are their titles. You can probably find them online, or you can look on the podcast site to link to them. Where I'm From by George Ella Lyon. Permission Granted by David Allen Sullivan. There's a third poem by Mary Oliver that I need to track down, so that one I haven't got the title of yet. Lori Wagner's website is 27powers.org. That's with the numbers 27. Good luck with this prompt, and please listen next week for another. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Calamity and Crow's Trading Post, twisting fresh tie-dyes for individuals, businesses, and organizations with standards like eyeballs, Jerry Bears, peace signs, and their signature tie-dyed mule. Custom artisan tie-dyes that rock. Contact Calamity and Crow's Trading Post on Facebook. And by The Farmhouse, Burlington's farm-to-table gastropub, serving award-winning burgers, innovative entrees, and a world-class beer menu. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. My co-host is Gary Lee Miller, and his website is GaryLeeMiller.com. Gary will be back with a new interview with Ellen Hopkins next week. If you have a guest to suggest, or comments about the show, or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Please remember that The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, Burlington, Vermont.